I'm Jake Panasevich, and today I'm joined by Dr. Robert Sapolsky to discuss his new book, Determined, A Science of Life Without Free Will, for episode number 59 of the Yoga with Jake podcast. Welcome to the podcast, where I interview world-renowned experts, top performers, and thought leaders in their field. And today, I am honored to bring to you my guest, Dr. Robert Sapolsky. As a boy, Robert Sapolsky dreamed of living inside the African dioramas in New York's Museum of Natural History. By age 21, he made it to Africa and joined a troop of baboons. Although being a naturalist appealed to him because it was a chance to get the hell out of Brooklyn, he never left people behind. In fact, he chose to live with the baboons because they are perfect for learning about stress and health in humans. Like their human cousins, baboons live in large, complex social groups with plenty of free time. Dr. Sapolsky writes, to devote to being rotten to each other. For a baboon or human, stress is rarely about evading a lion. Instead, it's mostly about members of your own species psychologically stressing you. And this is precisely when stress-related disease arises, Dr. Sapolsky explains in his book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And like people, baboons are good material for stories. His gift for storytelling led the New York Times to suggest if you crossed Jane Goodall with a Borscht Belt comedian, she might have written a book like A Primate's Memoir, Dr. Sapolsky's account of his years as a field biologist. Sapolsky's unique perspective on the human condition comes from his more than 30 years spent as both a field primatologist and a laboratory neuroscientist. As a result, he effortlessly moves from discussing pecking orders in primate societies, human and baboons, to explaining the neurochemistry of stress in ways that even science phobics readily understand. What fascinates Dr. Sapolsky most about human behavior is a paradox. We are both the most violent species on Earth, as well as the most altruistic, cooperative, and empathic. In his book, Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst, he examines how every act, heroic, appalling, or in between, is caused by neurobiology that occurred a second before, the environmental stimuli minutes before that triggered the neurobiology, hormonal influences during prior hours, all the way back to childhood and fetal experience sculpting our brains, and the effects of genes, culture, ecology, and evolution. Out of this comes a perspective that as biological organisms, we have far less free will than usually assumed. Dr. Sapolsky's most recent work focuses on how to think about this, whether considering the actions of a murderer or the actions of which you are praised. This synthesis is the basis of his new book, Determined, A Science of Life Without Free Will. Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst, is a New York Times bestseller, Washington Post Best Book of 2017, and received the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Sapolsky has also written A Primate's Memoir, which won the 2001 Bay Area Book Reviewers Award in nonfiction. Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, The Trouble with Testosterone, and Monkey Love and Other Essays on Our Lives as Animals, Dr. Sapolsky was awarded Rockefeller University's Lewis Thomas Prize for Writing About Science for 2008. His articles have appeared in publications such as Discover, The Los Angeles Times, The New Yorker, and The Wall Street Journal. Dr. Sapolsky is a MacArthur Genius Fellow, a professor of biology, neurology, and neurosurgery at Stanford University, and a research associate at the National Museum of Kenya. His 2008 National Geographic special on stress and his online lectures about human behavioral biology have been watched tens of millions of times. The humor and humanity he brings to sometimes sobering subject matter make Dr. Sapolsky a fascinating speaker. He lectures widely on topics as diverse as stress and stress-related diseases, biology, and the free will debate, the biology of our individuality, the biology of religious belief, depression, memory, schizophrenia, and Alzheimer's disease. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Robert Sapolsky.
Hello, Dr. Sapolsky. How are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
I'm doing well. I so appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. So you've got a new book, Determined, A Science of Life Without Free Will. And I was wondering how you first define free will.
Well, maybe the best way is for me to go at how most people define it and why that doesn't actually work. This is where people, I think, get into trouble, because we have incredibly strong intuitions that we're seeing free will in action. You got to make a decision. You're making a choice. You're picking between flavors of ice cream. You're choosing whether or not to shoot somebody, you know, one of those choices. You have an intent. And what we think about then is, well, are we consciously aware of this intent? Do we have a pretty good sense of what the outcome will be if we act on it? And most of all, do we know we don't have to do this? We have alternatives available to us. And for most people, that's necessary and sufficient to decide that you've just shown free will. You got intent, you know, you got it, you know, you don't have to do what you're doing, and you do what you do. And intuitively, that feels like agency to most people. And that's for the legal system. That's usually enough to decide that's where things are at in terms of culpability. And for my money, that has nothing whatsoever to do with free will, because it leaves out the only relevant question to ask as you sit there filled with your intent that you're about to act upon, which is, so how do you turn out to be the sort of person who would have that intent at that moment? And to simply look at, do you have intent and did you act on it, is like trying to evaluate a book by only reading the last paragraph of it or so. How do you turn out to be that sort of person? Because of biology, over which you had no control, interacting with environment, over which you had no control, from 1 second ago to back when you were a fetus, to your genes, to the culture your ancestors invented, and everything in between. And when you look at all those pieces, you know, the definition of free will has to become, here's a neuron, or here's a brain, or here's a person who just did something and did that completely free of its history, where it doesn't matter what the hormone levels were that morning. It doesn't matter what genes were. It doesn't matter what childhood trauma. It doesn't matter how the room smelled or like what color underwear the person is wearing today or any such thing. If that brain would have done the exact same thing with the history being completely different, that's free will. And nobody can show that. Hmm.
That definition is really fascinating. You know, as someone who's not a scientist, you know, you don't think of it that way. And do you think that's why we struggle with this idea and this notion that there is no free will? What is it about the human condition that makes your book provocative, you think?
Well, for one thing, we're going up against these really strong intuitions. The first one is when you decide, ooh, I'm going to scratch my nose right now, and whoa, I just showed free will, and unpacking that as the outcome of everything from a second ago to a million years ago is like really messy, because it's involving all sorts of stuff that we didn't know used to affect our behavior, and all sorts of things we're not consciously aware of, and things of that sort. The other intuition is, like, you look at somebody who's an amazing exception to what you would expect. Somebody who grew up under the worst of circumstances and tenacity and backbone, and they stuck it. And you look at that and you say, oh my God, that person has the most amazing willpower, what a display of free will. And we get suckered into that also, because we don't understand how that person became who they are as a result of 1 second ago, an hour ago, 1,000 years ago, that sort of thing. But more fundamentally, separate of like those specific circumstances, which just intuitively makes sense, you're seeing people being agents and captains of their own ship. More fundamentally, it like sucks to think that we have no control over who we are. It's very psychologically distressing to a lot of people under a lot of circumstances. I think is actually a great thing. But for most of us, it's actually kind of a bummer. And we emotionally run away from it. And who wants to admit you're a biological machine any more than like who wants to admit like our hearts are going to stop beating someday and there's no way out of it? It's psychologically pretty bruising for a lot of people.
Yeah. How do you reconcile ideas like when someone hears about determinism, or at least my mind goes to immediately like, well, I really pride myself in working hard and striving for something, right? And what you're saying is that capability is something that's built in then, that's predetermined. Is that right?
Well, okay, making a key yes with a key clarification that, ooh, just because everything was determined, everything is a result of biology, environment, blah, 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 that doesn't mean nothing can change. That doesn't mean you shouldn't bother trying. That doesn't mean society shouldn't bother trying. Just all sorts of ways in which, like, obviously, incredibly, like, dramatic changes occur. There's all sorts of people out there who are ex-white supremacists, and something changed. Change happened. But the critical thing is to recognize that we don't choose to change. We are changed by circumstance, and we are changed by circumstance as a function of the sort of person we got sculpted into being at the time that we experienced that circumstance. So there's massive change possible as long as we recognize it's not that we decide I need to have a different sort of nervous system than I had yesterday. We don't have that sort of volitional control. Okay, like great example. You have two people, they go, they see some movie, some inspirational movie, and they both come out of it changed by that experience. They both choose to do something differently in their life. Now, one of them comes out and says, oh my God, that was so inspirational. I'm going to now devote my free time volunteering in a soup kitchen or something. And they've been changed. The other person comes out and says, oh my God, that was so inspirational. I am now going to devote my life to studying the cinematographer who made that movie. Because that's incredible cinema. And okay, they've been changed by circumstance. As a result, they now choose to do different things in their life. But obviously as a function of they wound up being very different sort of people out of things they had no control over going into that movie, unless they were changed as a function of who they went into it being. So we change in those ways, but we are changed. We don't choose to change.
That's fascinating. For some reason, reading your book and hearing you talk, the biggest character that came to mind that would push back against this is someone like a David Goggins. Are you familiar?
No, I probably should be. Where's he coming from?
So he's a very famous public speaker. He's got a couple books, I believe a New York Times bestseller, on basically he really pushes for this idea that, you know, you could shape who you are. You do have the free will to become something, you know, great. And that he, you know, he's coming from a place where he had been very overweight. He came from a very poor family. He, you know, this is simplifying his narrative, but he joined the Marines and he's become this really inspirational sort of character for folks. And, you know, he's put in a ton of work and he's lost a ton of weight. But beyond that, you know, he'd gone through what he unpacks in his book is a lot of trauma in his history. How do you reconcile someone who's, I know you've done a lot of work with stress, depression, and even like trauma, you know, how it's hard not to get down on yourself or this idea of determinism when it comes to those issues. How do you reconcile something like that?
Well, the trouble is someone like that is inspirational and mysterious insofar as how did he turn out to be different from all sorts of people from similar backgrounds? And the answer is, which is totally unsatisfying, is because it wasn't the identical background. I mean, what we're tapping into here is there's this huge dichotomy in our heads between, there's all sorts of things are natural attributes where, like, everyone will say, yeah, you had no control over that. You are tall. You've got this color eyes. You have a good sense of musical pitch, and you've got perfect pitch. You were born a good athlete. You were born someone with a propensity towards being overweight. What you were, these were things you were handed in life. And people could accept that those are biological traits. And then where people make this massive mistake is deciding what you do with those traits. That isn't made of biology. That's made out of gumption and Calvinist backbone and tenacity, or it's made of self-indulgence and squandering. If your natural gifts were all wonderful, privileged ones, and then you throw it all away by squandering it, kind of thing. We see this false dichotomy between the traits you had no control over and what you do with them. And the latter is made of fairy dust, whatever it is. It's not made of brain stuff. And the key thing there is it's made of the exact same brain stuff as everything else about you. Where do you get your willpower from? Where do you get your emotional regulation? Where do you get your capacity for gratification postpartum? This is a part of the brain called the frontal cortex. That's all about that stuff. And that's the end product of what came a second ago and an hour ago and a million years ago as well. And, you know, how did he turn out to be somebody who not only had the willpower to do that, that was a biological trait, but the willpower to do that rather than the willpower to become like the best, you know, ethnic cleansing warlord in the history of like humankind. He could have devoted his energies to that. How did he not only like realize, oh, there's people out there who do stuff differently from me, I should be like that. Where did he get the self-reflective capacity to do that? How did he wind up being that sort of person? How did he wind up being the sort of person who would say, okay, I'm going to do this every single day from now on. And the next day, not say, screw it. I'll start tomorrow. How did that happen? All these cases where we view stuff that's really hard to imagine is made of the same biological stuff as like any of our other attributes, we instead decide that's where we're seeing, you know, the measure of somebody's character. It's made out of the same science. It's not magic.
It's interesting. And now, is how far is science behind, or are we there yet where we could track back how we've made these decisions, like these pathways, you know? Is there going to be a time that you see in the future where we could like map how we've come to make these decisions in life, or does science have a way of tracking?
Oh, I think absolutely. It's very good and like relatively easy by now to see how someone wound up the way they are. There's a challenge with it though. Okay, you take a jury and you're asking them to understand how this murderer wound up who they are. And sometimes it's really easy. This person, when they were 10, were in a horrible car accident, which destroyed their frontal cortex. And they spent 3 months in a coma and came out the other end. And they've had no ability to regulate their emotions ever since then. And are a totally like terrifying broken machine. And a fair percentage of juries, only about half of them in my experience, will sit there and say, it's not this guy's fault. Like he had this accident, did this brain damage, and that's why he turned out the way he is. So like, let's not put him to death. Let's like put him in an institution. Like we understand, whoa, there's an incredibly dramatic like cable made out of steel linking that car accident to who he is now. So that one's relatively easy. But then you look at like a run-of-the-mill murderer or a run-of-the-mill Nobel laureate and a run-of-the-mill saint or whatever, and you say, whoa, how'd they wind up this way? And the challenge there is there wasn't one singular car accident that explained everything. there's a billion microscopic little spider webs of history in that their prenatal experience was like this. Their childhood involved that. Their hormone levels were this 20 minutes before they did that amazing. There's like this zillion. And what's really hard to do is to realize you put together those gazillion little spider webs, and that forms as thick of a steel cable as that one car accident did. But it's just due to a zillion different influences, none of which were determinative, all of which just massaged the system a little bit. And 3/4 of those spider webs, we don't know anything about yet. And 3/4 of the remaining one, scientists only found out about the last decade or so. It's really hard to look at that one and see as many of those threads that got you there. But that's exactly the case. You know, here's one example. I think I write about this in the book, just, you know, this chance encounter I had. I was lecturing one day to a bunch of guys in the local county prison about how the brain works and stress and all of that. And like some guy came up to me afterward and he said, okay, so tell me this. I got an older brother. He's the vice president of a bank. And look at me. Look at how it turned out. And like, we've got 2 other siblings and they're in jail also. And like, what happened to him and what happened to me? And we talked through this for a while and eventually figured out what I think is the probable explanation. Oh, his brother is 4 inches taller than him. He happens to be tall and had very good visual spatial motor coordination. And in their shitty, awful neighborhood was playing basketball really well one day when the right person was walking by who turned out to be a recruiter for the fancy ass prep school on the other side of town and got him a scholarship there. And they trained him how to be part of the ruling class someday. And then he went to a Ivy League and like, he's tall. And he had better coordination than you, and the right person was walking past him one day, and that's how he turned out to be different. That's probably what went on. Or any of these, you look at people who, like, at every juncture in their life where they could have made the right decision, they made the wrong one every time because they did something impulsive or just stupid, and weren't they thinking, or they were thinking and thought this was a good idea, and just at every juncture. And then you look at stuff like, what were their mother's stress hormone levels while they were a fetus? That had something to do with how good their frontal cortex was going to wind up being at doing gratification postponement. What was the socioeconomic status of their family that they were born in? By age 5, if you stupidly picked the wrong family to be born into, by age 5, your frontal cortical maturation is already significantly affected by your parents' socioeconomic status. Be born poor, be raised poor, and by age 5, this part of the brain already is developing more slowly than most other people's on the average, and you're not as good at doing the harder thing when that's the right thing. And every step thereafter, and oh, how'd they wind up being somebody who at every juncture, yep, you guessed it, they made the wrong decision. They couldn't stop themselves. They pulled the gun out and robbed the liquor store. They couldn't stop themselves. They cheated on the exam and got caught. They could. How'd they wind up being that way? And it's not backbone. It's not their like ethical, moral compass. It's like, that's what life made their brain into.
I've started to come around to this more and more as I've heard you talk about this several times reading the book. I'm just trying, Dr. Sapolsky, to put a positive. Could you make me see this in a positive light, please? Because that's really... Oh, yeah. Difficult for me to put a positive spin on this. Like, how does this make life easier?
Okay. First, let me tell all the ways in which you shouldn't get bummed out. People immediately say, oh my God, if there's no free will, if you convince people there's no free will, everybody's just going to run amok. There's a whole science showing that people are not going to just run amok. Oh my God, we're going to have murderers running around on the streets. That's not a problem in the slightest, because we can build a society in which we protect people from dangerous individuals without invoking free will, without invoking rotten souls, without that could be done as well. They say, oh my God, well, nothing could ever change. No, things can change as long as you don't. But then you're left with this, like, okay, tell me something encouraging. Why shouldn't I be bummed out about this? Like, what if, you know, I've got some like impressive college degree. I didn't earn that. Oh, I've found love in my life. I love my wife. She loves me. I didn't earn that. That was just biological. Oh, I'm the CEO of a corporation and make some like ghastly, enormous like salary. What, I didn't really earn that? Bummer. That's so deflating if I'm not really responsible for having been a kind person or a smart person or a success. Total bummer. And for that, I have a very simple answer, because it's very pertinent to you and me, and I bet the sort of people listening to this broadcast, which is, if the news that maybe you didn't earn the good things in your life is a bummer, by definition, it means you're one of the lucky humans. You've got electricity. You're listening to the radio. You've got glasses. Somebody like was able to realize that you needed glasses, and you're in a culture and a westernized whatever where you got glasses. You, like, I've got running water. I don't have intestinal parasites. I don't have like all the ways in which like life turned out lucky. And if you're bummed out about the fact that maybe you didn't really earn your prestigious place in life or earn love or regard on the parts of people, all of that, what it means is, by definition, you're one of the people who's been treated better than average because of things you had no control over. And where this really is good news is for the vast number of people who've been treated worse than average because of stuff they had no control over. If no free will is a bummer, it means you're one of the lucky ones who could afford to be like deflated by the fact that you didn't really earn your Nobel Peace Prize or whatever. For most people, it's, oh, you didn't have a chance if you were born that way. Oh, you didn't have a hope being born into that sort of neighborhood. Oh, it's not that you're like stupid and unmotivated and lazy, and that's why you don't read very well. You got dyslexia. There's a neurobiology of why your brain turned out this way that you had no. Oh, it's not that you like have no self-control and you secretly hate yourself. You're overweight because you and your family have a version of this gene that has something to do with feeling a satiation signal in your brain. Oh, every step in history where we have figured out, wow, witches don't really control the weather. Wow, people with epilepsy really aren't sleeping with Satan. Wow, mothers don't cause schizophrenia because they secretly hate their child. Every time we figured out, oh, actually, no, there was no free will there. There was no responsibility. It's a biological phenomenon. All sorts of people suddenly got treated way better in life. It's a good thing, freeing us from a notion that we have responsibility for things that we really don't. Is an enormously liberating thing.
It's interesting. It's really interesting. Now, where does a human's capability to improve themselves come in? Or does it?
Yeah, it does. It's okay. Very, very relevant. And it has to do with a totally bizarre thing about us. Like we're biological machines, like every other, other primate or a brine shrimp or a single cell amoeba. We're all biological machines. The weird thing about us, though, is we're the only species that can know that we're biological machines, that could have insights as to where the buttons are and where the levers are and can act upon that. So you could wind up being the sort of person who's saying, okay, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And like, hooray, I've gotten to this point. And I know the sort of machine that I am, except we never state it that way. I know that if I walk down this block and walk past that bar, I'm going to feel that craving. And thus, instead, I'm going to walk down this other street and get to where I'm going through that other route. Whoa, how do you turn out to be? Because you're a machine with meta level awareness of where your buttons are and where your levers are and stuff like that. And you were capable, you turned out to be someone who is smart enough to have that insight. Oh, if I walk down this block, I'm going to feel that craving. You turned out to be the sort of individual who, nonetheless, even thinking about that bar down that block there, doesn't feel the craving so strongly that he actually can't go and go down the different block instead. You are somebody who turned out to have a respect for self-reflection like that. You have so you turned out to be that sort of person and someone who is capable of understanding, that's how I work. Or you could be the sort of person who, as a result of sitting and listening to this conversation, you were changed by it. You come out saying, I'm totally convinced I've got no free will, or you can come out saying, I'm totally convinced this guy is full of it and is making no sense at all. By being the sort of person who would listen to this, you were changed in a particular way. And maybe coming out the other end, you even have turned out to be the sort of person who could reinforce what just happened. You're saying, whoa, that's so interesting. I'm going to go out and buy this guy's book and read it. Or, oh, that's so interesting. I'm going to go out and buy this guy's book and burn it because it's gibberish. And you would thus reinforce who you've become even further. Wow, what an amazing inspirational movie. I never knew anything about that. I'm going to go out and learn more about it. Like, we're machines, but we know our machineness. And some of the time that could be a totally demoralizing bummer. Once again, if we're the lucky ones, oh my God, what's the meaning of life? But most of the time, what it means is we understand how to reinforce certain tendencies in ourselves. We understand how we became the sort of people we are, or we understand what kind of people we are. And thus, don't do that because you're going to get pulled in that way. Or this is the thing that inspires me. So put on this music. Put on this music and I'm going to be inspired. Put on that music and I'm just going to get distracted and not be able to pay attention. Oh, I've learned that about myself. And I have enough detachment that I can say, oh, don't put on that music. Put on the incredibly boring Gregorian chant so I can pay attention instead of listening to Taylor Swift or something. Yeah, that's where our insights into ourselves be the gears by which we change.
So change is possible then, even in determinism.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the knowledge that it happens and the knowledge that it can happen this circumstance more than in that circumstance or whatever, that winds up being a roadmap for how you then make it more likely. You've become the sort of person who, as a result of being in this situation, being changed in this way, has the power to make sure you now wind up in another version of that same situation again to reinforce that further, or, you know, any version of that.
Okay. And where does momentum have any part in this? Like, someone makes a bad decision or has a bad experience and they continue to kind of, or they become addicted to something because of a choice or an outside, the company they're around, the people they're around, or, you know, is there like a cascade effect in determinism?
Yeah. And here's like a great distressing example of it. There's this, the philosophers, I'm not a philosopher, writing this book forced me to actually read some of them and it was agonizing, but most philosophers admit that there's things like atoms and cells and molecules and stuff, yet somehow that's compatible with still believing in free will, compatibilist philosophers. And one of the leading ones is this guy, Dan Dennett, a very influential philosopher, who famously always uses this analogy of free will is out there and we are able to recover from bad luck at one point in life with good luck, and bad and good luck average out over time. And he always has this metaphor, like if you're in a 100-yard dash and you start 10 feet behind everybody else, you're screwed. That's totally unfair. But if you're running a marathon and you start off 10 feet behind everybody else, you know, you should be in. There's lots of opportunities to overcome it, because after all, bad luck and good luck average out over time. Here's why that's not the case in the slightest. And instead, there's a momentum to bad luck and a momentum to good luck. You're born a crack baby because you had the horrible bad luck of spending 9 months being marinated in your mother's substance abuse. Whoa, does society step in at that point and make sure you get incredible sort of therapy for neurodevelopmental problems you're going to have? No. You're going to be almost certainly mired in poverty because, okay, are they going to at least make sure your mother is nurturant and reach to you at night? No, she's going to be a total mess as a consequence. Okay, are they going to at least make sure you go to good schools and live in a safe neighborhood? No, you know, you're going to have horrible underfunded schools and the neighborhood is going to be dangerous and you're going to be ganged and all. And every step is just going to be made worse and worse by every step that came. And in the same way, you're born where you spent 9 months getting folic acid and lots of nutrients. So you're born with a great brain ready to go in your upper middle class family of like high tech overachievers who are going to get you music lessons. And when the time comes, we're going to drill the hell out of you in time for the SATs. And like every step just builds on the momentum of the good or bad luck that came before. Great example of this. This is a paper coming out. This is a study of baboons. Baboons, wild monkeys running around a national park in East Africa, and showing, okay, were you born with a certain type of bad luck? Were you born in a season where there was a drought going on? And what they show is what's sort of the genetic signature that you're still carrying in adulthood as a result of that. But what if you have doubly bad luck? You were born in a drought season, and your mother was low ranking. And what you see is you get synergistically bad luck, the sort of genetic scars you're going to have 25 years of. Same thing, whether you're a baboon or a human, luck doesn't even out over time. It's momentum in both the worst direction and the best direction.
Yeah, that's now, was there. Pretty much you've gone over a lot of my questions about the book, but is there anything else that you want to put out about your thesis in the book on determinism? Anything that you would think would provide some clarity for folks on this that we didn't cover?
Well, one thing I'm realizing I wish I had emphasized more, you know, in the book and since then, is, okay, if you really think through the implications of all of this, blaming someone for something, punishing them for something makes no sense whatsoever. We've got to completely throw out the basic premise of the criminal justice system. Oh my God, are we going to have murderers running around the street? No, there's ways to solve that, but we need a massive change in how we think about all of that. That one's easy, because the other implication of all of this is that praising someone or rewarding somebody makes no sense either, and we have to throw out meritocracies to the exact same extent. And that one's a much tougher one, because you think about, okay, we got no more criminal justice system. How do we protect people from dangerous people? There's ways you constrain them, you quarantine them. There's a whole world of sort of criminology revolutionary thinking about that going on these days. But the flip side of meritocracies is, oh no, if we throw out free will and all its implications, not only are there murderers running around the streets, but you get a brain tumor and they're going to pick a random person off the street to take out your brain tumor because we don't believe in elitist meritocracies anymore. Ugh, that's a problem. not only if we throw out blame and punishment and praise and reward, do we have to protect people from dangerous people, we have to make sure people are benefiting from competent people without having meritocracies that mean by age five, it's already obvious which kids are going to Yale and which kids are going to the county prison. We have to have a system where just because you're really good at something, you get a salary 10 times higher than the average person who you employ in your company, you know, all that stuff. That one's a big challenge because we got a country that runs on myths about meritocracy and that people get what they deserve and it's a just world. And like when you see the top 1% of the socioeconomic spread in this country owns 40% of the wealth, you see there's a real problem there with meritocracies. But that one's going to be much harder because it's relatively easy to solve how to keep somebody who's got a broken brain and is a remorseless person, incapable of empathy and a sociopathic murderer, just put them up somewhere where they can't hurt anybody. But how do you solve the problem that it takes a hell of a lot of motivation and training and time to go study hard enough to be a neurosurgeon? How are you going to motivate somebody to do that if you're not going to have them in a society that says things like, wow, you're a better human than average because you're capable of doing this? That's going to be a much harder problem. And I don't know how that one gets solved.
Yeah, maybe a book for the future. And that's, oh gosh, it seems so complicated. You brought up some of your work in the field with baboons. What's it like working with baboons, and what are some of your maybe most cherished or greatest moments that you've had working with baboons there?
Well, baboons, first to orient, I'm mostly a lab neurobiologist. I've spent like forever, 9 months each year being in a lab and doing stuff with test tubes and sticking genes into neurons and things like that. But for more than 30 years, every summer, I would spend 3 months studying a population of wild baboons out in a national park in East Africa. So the first 10 years by myself, eventually my wife and I both doing the work. And what we were always interested in is what does like being a baboon in baboon society have to do with who gets stress-related diseases? Why is that interesting? My original roots were in stress biology. What are the effects of stress on the brain? And trying to understand this in baboons. Baboons turned out to be perfect. Baboons, they're smart. They live in these big groups of 50 to 100 animals out in the savanna. It's like a great ecosystem. Lions don't mess with them because they're big and aggressive and can fight off lions. They only have to forage about 3 hours a day for their day's calories. And this has this amazing implication, which is they've got 9 hours of free time every day to be completely miserable to each other. All they're about is social competition and jockeying in the hierarchy and stabbing somebody in the back and being a jerk. And like, they're the most viciously petty animals out there beyond humans. They're perfect. They're perfect models for westernized stress, because if you get a baboon who's getting a peptic ulcer or has high blood pressure, it's not because lions are chasing him every day. It's because some other baboon is generating psychological stress for him. They're perfect models for westernized psychosocial stress. So they were like great to study. I do not love baboons. There's a few baboons over the years who I wound up loving because they're miserable, seeming like untrustworthy animals who are like, they have the highest rates of aggression of any non-human primate. Your average male baboon dies of the consequences of another male baboon. It's just, but they're amazing for studying a world in which you've got organisms that have enough free time and are smart enough to just generate psychological stress for each other. So like you'll see, like in terms of what like anecdotes or what like typifies a baboon's life, you see this low-ranking baboon and he's sitting there and he's like digging in the ground to pull out some root tuber thing to eat that's kind of good. And it takes him about 20 seconds of doing this. And he's just about to eat it. And along comes a high ranking guy who boots him out of there and like takes it away from him. So our guy like walks away and sits down and digs out a tuber from 20 yards away. And the high ranking guy goes, and does it again to him, and does it every 45 seconds for an hour and a half. There's 100 billion of these things out in the field all over the place. The high-ranking guy could get any one that he wants out there and just dig this out to eat. And what happens instead is he could just do this to this guy. He could do it all day long, and it's just for the sheer pleasure of rubbing this guy's nose in it, and he will devote all of this morning's effort into just making this other guy miserable and doing it over and over and over again. That's what these guys are about. So they're not nice guys. They're not nice guys, but they're very informative about, socially complex creatures who can afford to make each other unhappy.
And what, I don't know if you have you've obviously done so much work, but any major takeaways from that experience as far as like, what were your findings involving now? What were you looking at? It'd be chronic stress or what were you exactly? Yeah. Takeaways from it.
These are animals. You observe them. You do the whole basic Jane Goodall scene. But in addition, we were able to dart them, anesthetize them with blowguns, and then see how their bodies were working, that sort of thing. And I think I got two big take-home lessons out of it. One is when you look at the nuts and bolts of what's going wrong in the body of a low-ranking baboon, in terms of stress and hormones and all of that, it is remarkably similar to the nuts and bolts of what's going on in the body of somebody with major depression. Remarkably similar in terms of the workings of it. And being low ranking and major depression are both about learning to be helpless and learning to be hopeless and that sort of thing. So remarkably similar. The other thing that I learned, which in lots of ways was like the most important lesson, and it took me 20 years to get there, was like, if you got a choice in the matter and you want to have a nice, healthy body that deals with stress well, if you have a choice between being high ranking or having a lot of social affiliation and lots of social grooming, and this is still a scientific word for baboons, friends and that sort of thing, choose the friends every time. Social affiliation was a much better predictor of health and long life and that sort of thing. Dominance rank, you know, it's flashy and seductive for like most humans and most baboons. But in terms of just having a healthy body afterward, go for having like stable grooming relationships instead every time. That'll do you better.
I love that. I always feel like you become the company you keep sometimes.
Yeah, very much so.
Excellent. What's next for you? Anything else coming up? Where could folks find you? And where could I point folks to
I know nothing about 18th century technology or anything more recent than that. But my 20-something kids apparently have set up some online presence for me, and I don't even know how to describe it beyond that. So they're putting up all sorts of things. The book is available, Penguin, Random House. It got published in October. I'm just finishing up the edits this week for the soft cover, which will come out sometime later this year. And then after that, I don't know, I've written down every thought I have in my head. So I'm basically going to sit empty-headed for a while after that and see what happens after next.
Excellent. Is there another book on the horizon, you think, after this one?
None that I could foresee at the moment, mainly because I spent a large part of the last 5 years, instead of writing this book, mostly sitting around saying, okay, I'm not going to be able to write this book, this one, I bit off more than I could chew on this one. So I think I'm going to have to work up some steam to like possibly go near this kind of venture again for a while. So I think I'm officially sort of in the post-parturition exhaustion phase.
Wonderful. Well, it's a really fascinating book, and I've always at afar admired your work. And I was so elated to that you said yes to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. And I really love the dog too. He's cute.
Oh, he's just sort of coming in here now and then, and he's for having a grooming relationship with.
Wonderful. Oh, good.
Thank you for having me on. This was fun.
Awesome. And yeah, I'd love to do it again sometime. I will send this out to you when I have it up, I hope as early as Monday even.
Great. Okay, good. Thanks for letting me know.
Yeah. And I really appreciate your time. And yeah, thanks again.
You too. Good. Take care then.
Thanks for tuning in. If you found my conversation with Dr. Sapolsky to be engaging, if it got you thinking, please give the podcast a like, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe. You can find me on all social media platforms at Yoga with Jake, especially on Instagram, and on my website, yogawithjake.com. Until next time, take care.